From the North Carolina Reading Service, this program intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week. Our weekly issue, read today by John Federson, is dated December the 8th, 2023. I'm actually recording this on the 7th, Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day, but the Indie Week is also online at indieweek.com, and that's where you can find some of these articles in more detail, or you can listen to this program again at our podcast section. Here we go. We'll begin in Durham. As we often do, there are three articles specific to Durham, and the first is dated actually a couple of weeks ago. Two days ago, Durham's new city council was sworn in on Monday. Durham City Hall was unusually packed for the city council meeting. Hundreds of residents and visitors filled the chamber, anxiously anticipating a changing of the guard in Durham politics. Mayor Elaine O'Neill officially retired from the city's top seat at the beginning of Monday's meeting. She was joined by her colleagues Monique Hosey-Hyman and Jillian Johnson as the three outgoing members of city council. Councillor Mark Anthony Middleton said, "We come now to a simple and sacred moment in our democracy, and that is the peaceful and orderly transition of power, not at the end of a rifle, but at the end of a promise." O'Neill and Johnson chose not to run for re-election back in the summer. O'Neill served only one term after taking over from former Mayor Steve Shule in 2021. Johnson was the most senior member of council, having been elected to her at-large seat for the first time back in 2015. Hosey-Hyman, who is serving out the remainder of a term she took over in May of 2022 for council member Charlie Reese, ran unsuccessfully this fall to keep her at-large seat. All three outgoing members were aligned in their gratitude toward families, colleagues, city staff, and the residents of Durham. O'Neill said, "During her final remarks, I thank God for the council, my colleagues here tonight. We've had our times, but I know one thing. The people you see sitting in front of you, they love this city. And so I thank them for the lessons they've taught me, both now and going forth. And I also know they're going to do an absolute great job." Relations between members of the city council have been contentious for most of 2023 due to a number of well-documented incidents, not to mention actual policy disagreements. At the previous work session on November 21st, old wounds were still being agitated, leading O'Neill to end the meeting by saying that choosing Middleton as her mayor pro tem was her, quote, only regret. But attitudes were mostly cordial on Monday night as O'Neill, Hosey-Hyman, and Johnson addressed the audience one last time. O'Neill said, "For the residents of Durham, I appreciate being from a hometown that would take a little girl from the west end of Durham and raise her up to be a mayor. We are always Bull City Strong." The three outgoing members left the chamber to a standing ovation, and a new chapter in Durham politics began. After a brief recess to swap out the nameplates that are placed in front of each seat, the remaining members of council welcomed two new colleagues to the dais and welcomed back two more, Carol Rist and Nate Baker, who both won at-large seats during elections this fall, were officially sworn into their positions. The two were joined by current council member Javiera Caballero, who won her second term. She first took office in 2018 to replace incoming mayor Steve Shule. The energy in City Hall remained palpable as Leonardo Williams stepped to the podium to officially become the 41st mayor of Durham, sworn in by NC Supreme Court Justice Anita Earls. The newly elected mayor was swarmed by family, friends, and a bevy of his Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity brothers donning black and gold suits. "We have work to do," Williams said, "but I say to Durham, we won't do it alone. We are officially writing our new story together because we are greater together." Former mayors Wib Gully, Steve Shule, and Nick Tennyson were in attendance to give their support to the transition of power. former council member and state representative Vernetta Alston, and North Carolina Congresswoman Valerie Fouché also attended the ceremony. And we'll pass right along to a Board of Education meeting held on November the 16th. A new North Carolina law called the Parents' Bill of Rights drew a packed house of speakers. Then, on November 16th, many community members urged the board to delay implementing the law, but some called for speedier compliance. Ashley Gulch, an anthropologist, echoing comments by several other speakers, saying, reject this bill and enact a policy that protects queer youth. However, not all speakers agreed. Rosaria Butterfield, a 61-year-old retired professor, urged the board to implement the new law. Following the law, she said, also protects each and every one of you. The Parents' Bill of Rights, which the General Assembly passed in August after overriding Governor Cooper's veto, mandates schools to notify parents regarding any changes in their students' mental, emotional, or physical health services, and inform the parents if the student requests name or pronoun changes. The law also prohibits curriculum content on gender identity, sexual activity, or sexuality in kindergarten through fourth grade, and grants parents access to review all curriculum and view all materials that students borrow from the school library. North Carolina school districts were given extensions for compliance with some elements of the law, but several school districts are grappling with what to do to respond to community concerns and how to interpret it. At the DPS meeting, community members, some dressed in neutral suits, dresses, and Patagonia jackets, while others wore rainbow leggings and caps and dangly, colorful jewelry, filled every seat in the room and spilled into the hallway. People took seats in the hallway and watched the live screen, waiting for their turn to enter the room and comment. Several speakers mentioned that challenges to the law are already underway. The Campaign for Southern Equality, that's a Western North Carolina LGBTQ rights advocacy group, is currently preparing a federal Title IX complaint. Sarah Whitehall, a parent of a DPS student, urged the board to delay policy decisions until the issue is settled, saying, I would much prefer to see our tax dollars be spent educating our children and not fighting those battles out in court. Elizabeth Schatzer, parent of two school-aged children, echoed this statement. History does not remember those who made the least bad policy. We remember those who took a stand and said no. A couple of parents shared personal experiences as parents of LGBTQ children. Neil Allen, choking back tears, said, make it easier for the kids, that's all I'm saying. The school board tabled the most controversial policies for further discussion. The board plans to have new drafts of the policies available by its meeting on December the 14th. Millicent Rogers, board member, said, we are revising them again to include more inclusive language and provide more clarity on what is allowed within the guidelines. The Chapel Hill Carborough School District discussed similar policy changes in their work session on November 2nd and also delayed the decision for further policy review. Buncombe County Board also recently postponed similar changes and moved to review again in December. Rogers said in her email, we, as a board, understand that we have to follow the law. We also recognize that this state law is in direct conflict with Title IX. It's in our duty to provide an interpretation of the law for our administration to create procedures that will continue to protect all of our students and educators. Now, the third Durham article is one I seem to recall reading last week, but it involves Durham water levels in Durham County. You may not be able to finish singing your favorite song in the shower. Durham officials are encouraging water conservation measures in light of dipping water levels. The Department of Water Management reports lower than usual levels in two of its reservoirs, Lake Mishi and Little River. Lake Mishi, considered full at 341 feet, measured about 328 as of November the 14th. prompting the city to announce a nautical no-go on launching motorized boats from Mishi's ramp. Historically, Mishi and Little River dip during the fall and early winter season. Sydney Miller, the water resource manager for the Department of Water Management, is watching those numbers closely, saying, "We are always concerned about water. It's something we always pay attention to. The water supply is lower now than it is usually at this time of year." The city has about 80 days left of easily accessible premium water. Meanwhile, the daily demand still hovers at about 29 million gallons per day, putting pressure on the city's aqueous reserves. Even so, Miller is not too distressed. While reservoir levels are unusually low right now, they've been even lower at some points in the past. He says, "The expectation is that we are approaching a time that we expect refill, and there's been no indication from the National Weather Service that this winter will be drier than usual. The expectation is that we will see refill in both reservoirs." Don't ditch the short showers just yet, though. Water Management encourages residents to take proactive steps to conserve the city's precious water by fixing leaks, running full loads of laundry and dishes, and reducing those shower times. Miller hopes Durham residents can return to boating on Lake Mishi soon. In the meantime, every drop counts. All right, let's move over to Chapel Hill and UNC Chapel Hill articles. The first is called Geeks and Greeks. Chapel Hill Council approves a Longfellow proposal, denies rezoning for a tower next to a sorority house. Wednesday night marked the last business meeting of the year for the Chapel Hill Town Council, but there were no lame ducks in sight as the council voted on two different proposals for two 150-foot buildings downtown. The council denied the first, a 12-story luxury condo tower, and approved the second, a wet lab that was a litmus test for opinions on development in the recent mayoral and council elections. Since a majority of council members will be back in January, the tale of two proposals gave a preview of the year to come. The denial of the residential tower showed that while the pro-growth faction won a mandate for moving Chapel Hill forward, even the most development-friendly members were hesitant to cross some lines on setbacks, heights, and transitions on a lot next to the historic district. The meeting brought out what may have been the most bizarre community crossover of the year, as Dungeons and Dragons nerds joined forces with sorority sisters to speak against the plan for a 157-foot building at 157 East Rosemary Street. The current building at that address, which would be demolished to make way for the tower, is home to the Gathering Place, a self-described nerd bar with a love of fantastical card and board games. The development would also cast a shadow over the next-door UNC Chapel Hill Phi Mu sorority house, and apparently ruin the charm of their private patio. Most council members liked the design of the building, but were uncomfortable with such a tall structure on a small lot, one-third of an acre, that borders the historical district. Councilmember Amy Ryan said if you moved this a couple blocks down Rosemary Street on the south side of the street, it'd be a big thumbs up for me, but I'm feeling like this is the wrong building for this place. And while they were sympathetic to the Geeks and Greeks, several members cautioned that development was probably still on its way to 157 East Rosemary. Mayor-elect Jess Anderson said, "We do need to expect this building is going to redevelop." She told Lovers of the Gathering Place that when redevelopment happens, the town will be there to help with relocation. Councilmember Camille Berry pointed out her discomfort with some of the arguments used by the predominantly white sorority in protecting the charm of their patio and house, especially in the context of the affordable housing crisis of the town. "Let's be careful about holding on to charm and character," Berry said, "because what is charming and characteristic to one can feel very exclusive to another if you're outside that group. And I have to tell you, it was startling to see pictures and also to see a group here that looks very homogenous. Barry was the only one to vote for the proposal, which failed 7-1. Council member Tay Huyn was absent from the meeting. The second development proposal was Longfellow Building. That's a 9-story wet lab at 306 West Franklin. That project has been pending for the past year, catching attention because its construction would displace businesses like the Purple Bowl. In October, the Purple Bowl announced it had found a new location on Franklin Street. After a few design and procedural questions, the council approved the Longfellow Building with a 7-1 vote. Adam Searing, the lone dissenter, unsuccessfully ran for mayor this year. The Longfellow proposal was a perpetual target of critique during his campaign. Searing said on Wednesday, citing vacancy rates in wet labs in the Boston area, "With this project, Chapel Hill is kind of like the surfer who tries to catch a big wave and fails and gets clobbered by the next one. Well, I think this project could be something that might work. It's an industry that is experiencing an extreme downturn, and having a large, empty building on Franklin is not going to create a vibrant downtown." For outgoing Mayor Pam Heminger, who did not seek re-election, the Longfellow approval was a capstone of her 4 terms in office. Especially in her last term, she emphasized the need to balance Chapel Hill's commercial tax base, skewed by the presence of large, tax-exempt public university. She argued that a lab building would help sustain a year-round economy instead of relying on 9 months of student traffic. Councilmember Michael Parker, who also didn't run for re-election, said, "I really would have a hard time thinking of a better way to go out the door." Now, my next article starts in Chapel Hill at the university, but it is a statewide interest because it concerns the flagship UNC Chapel Hill chancellorship and Kevin Guskowitz. He confirmed that he is weighing taking a presidency at Michigan State University, but he has not officially resigned his position, saying only that he's still considering the next move. Meanwhile, trustees, faculty members, students, and even legislators have urged him to either continue leading UNC or move on. Michigan State University's Board of Trustees earlier led a botched chancellor search in which confidential information was leaked and another final candidate dropped out. That board has not officially decided on the troubled university's next leader. UNC System President Peter Hans, who will unilaterally choose an interim chancellor should Guskowitz leave, has made no public statements about that choice, or who might sit on the search committee to vet candidates for the next permanent chancellor. Marty Kotis, a member of the Board of Trustees and a former member of the UNC System Board of Governors, said, "What there is plenty of rumor and innuendo. There's a lot of rumor-mongering around this stuff. Somebody hears something, they take it as a fact, they repeat it as a fact." Kotis says he's heard plenty of possible scenarios, that the interim could be UNC Chapel Hill Provost Chris Clemens, UNC Chapel Hill Trustee Malcolm Turner, or UNC Board of Governors member Lee Roberts. Other names in the mix, including sitting chancellors at other system campuses. He's heard people say that the interim appointment will ultimately be chosen as a permanent appointment, even before a search committee has been formed or had a single meeting. Kota said, "I haven't heard from anybody who actually knows the mind of Peter Hans and who he may be appointing as an interim. And the Board of Governors would not already be having discussions about a permanent replacement either. I think people are not really aware of how this actually works." Kotis served on the system's Board of Governors when Hans was hired as president and has maintained a warm relationship with him. Like most good leaders, Kotis said, Hans thinks contingency planning is important. He's also known for prizing and publicly emphasizing the need for confidentiality in searches and appointments. I'm sure he has names in mind for various interims at various times, and should. And Peter has the authority to choose these interim chancellors, but any discussion about who that is, whether it's among the trustees or anyone else outside of Peter, that is speculation. No one has applied for the chancellorship, nor has a search committee been formed. For those reasons, Cota said he would find it highly unlikely that Hans might have already decided on Chapel Hill's next permanent chancellor. Two members of the UNC System Board of Governors spoke with NC Newsline this week, asking that their names be withheld because they are not authorized to speak for the system or weigh in on confidential searches. I might mention that NC North Carolina Newsline is a partner now of Indy Week, or a source for many of their articles. According to a new policy on searches adopted in May, Hans will choose the members of any chancellor search committee and, in consultation with that chair, select 13 voting members. As president, Hans will himself sit on the committee. Previously, members of the Board of Governors were not allowed to act as voting members on such committees, but they are now required to do so. The committee will advance an unranked slate of candidates to the campus Board of Trustees, who will in turn present at least three unranked candidates to the president. The system president will then present a final nominee to the Board of Governors for a vote. One provision of this new search policy has led some to conclude candidates from within North Carolina, and especially candidates already within the UNC system, would be favored. The provision reads, "The president, in consultation with the officers of the Board of Governors, shall undertake reasonable efforts to develop potential chancellor candidates within the UNC system and shall ensure that opportunities for chancellor vacancies are promoted in a manner that encourages interest from well-qualified candidates who are current residents of the state of North Carolina." Several members of the Board of Governors and Board of Trustees said they have heard people quote that provision in speculating UNC system functionaries and members of governing boards will be considered first when chancellor seats come open. One of the board members said, "The truth is some people on these boards do want these jobs, and some have good reasons for starting a rumor. Sometimes a board member will do that themselves if they're looking for a job and they want to get it out there. We've seen that. Sometimes someone will say it's going to be anyone. We've heard NC House Speaker Tim Moore was going to be a chancellor over here, or that politician was going to be made president of the system. And then when it doesn't happen, everyone's relieved because at least it wasn't that person. There's a game that gets played that way." Another board member said they understood why people are concerned. Just 2 years ago, Darrell Allison, then a member of the UNC Board of Governors, left his board seat to become a candidate in the chancellor search at Fayetteville State University that was already well underway. Though trustees said he wasn't among their top candidates, he was ultimately chosen for the university's top leadership position despite having no background in higher education beyond being a political appointee. The Board of Governors member said, "I think that was handled very badly. Whether or not you like Darrell, and I do, and I think he's done a good job, I think that just confirmed people's feelings that this is all political. It's all about who you know and not about qualifications or giving people who are part of the community and the university a real role to play in choosing a chancellor. It just made it look like we're handing out jobs to ourselves, to our own members. So every time there's a chancellor search, you have that hanging over you." But an appointment at a small and struggling historically black college or university, HBCU, is one thing, the board member said. The recent appointment of Kimberly Van Noort, a UNC system office favorite who was made interim chancellor and then given a full-time job at UNC Asheville, might also get a minimum of scrutiny. "But UNC Chapel Hill is not a struggling regional university," said the board member. "It was the nation's first public university and the flagship in a 16-campus system. Its graduates often go on to powerful political positions within state and federal government, legal circles, and the media. The public's interest and interest from a vast and influential network of alumni are likely to lead to much more scrutiny of any chancellor search and how it is conducted. The board member said, if this is a political choice, if it's seen as a patronage pick, when you're likely looking at one of the most competitive fields of candidates we are likely to see for any chancellor search at any of our universities, it's just going to destroy all credibility. They also went on, there are some members who just think they're always going to say it's political. It's always going to be, they're destroying our universities. Vote Democrat, no matter what we do. So why not just put in whoever we want? But if you've been around a while and you've seen how some of these things go, you really have to make these choices carefully. I think Peter Hans is smart enough to know that. While some members of the Board of Trustees and governors dismiss speculation that decision has already been made, they aren't necessarily dismissing some of the names about which people are speculating. Figures like Clemens, Turner, and Roberts could all make good leaders. Trustee Dave Buliak told Newsline this week. Among those three, Roberts, a budget director under former Republican Governor Pat McCrory, lacks any university administrative experience. But Buliak said that's not an issue for him when looking at potential leaders of a university. Buliak said, I would point to Mitch Daniels as a president, who I think did an excellent job at Purdue, referring to the former Republican governor of Indiana, who served as president of one of that state's flagship public universities from 2013 until the end of last year. Daniels' presidency, coming directly on the heels of his last term as governor, has been held up by some as a further dangerous melding of higher education and politics, and by others as an example of how politicians and business leaders with no experience in academia can be credible university leaders. It really depends on what you mean by credible, said Buliak. The president of the United States, judged by Republican leadership, is poor, and vice versa, so it really depends. That's what you define as credibility. I don't think there is necessarily a requirement the head of a top research university be someone from academia. Who's the best person is for the job would depend on the list of candidates and who's interested in doing the job. Kotas also said he wouldn't dismiss any candidate strictly because of a lack of experience at universities or within academia. I think there are a lot of people from a lot of areas who can provide effective leadership, he said. As students, faculty, alumni, and political appointees in North Carolina debate potential successes for Guskiewicz, the situation at Michigan State is far from healthy or transparent. The board has a meeting scheduled upcoming December 15th with an agenda that says it will consider a personnel matter, but trustees and faculty are said they aren't sure what will come of it. Michigan State's trustees are not politically appointed but directly elected in partisan elections. While it can be argued that such a system makes trustees more directly accountable to the public, it can lead to conflict, particularly during times of crisis. Michigan State has had no shortage of those moments in recent years. As with Carolina, Michigan State's trustees have been accused of bringing political pressure and interfering with administrators. The campus has had six presidents since 2018. When former Olympic gymnastics physician and university doctor Larry Nassar was sentenced for crimes related to child pornography and sexual assault. Then, MSU president Lou Anna K. Simon left when she was drawn into and eventually charged in an investigation that examined which university administrators knew about Nassar's year of abuse. Charges against Simon were eventually dropped. Former Republican Governor John Engler followed Simon as an interim leader, but he resigned in 2019. His tenure also dominated by the Nassar abuse scandal. Another interim president, Satish Udpa, took the helm until Samuel Stanley was chosen as the permanent position in 2019. He left in 22 after clashing with trustees over an investigation into alleged Title IX reporting failures over which the dean of the university's College of Business was forced to resign. Teresa Woodworth has acted as interim at MSU since, but decided against seeking the permanent position. A member of the university's board of trustees who asked their name be withheld in order to discuss internal board debates said few blamed Woodruff, saying, "If you look at what has been going on and the way that every crisis is used as political cudgel, you can see why we've had a problem hiring and retaining leaders here." The current bungled chancellor search process is yet another example, said this member. Last month, the names of Guskowitz and University of Texas at San Antonio President Taylor Aimi were leaked as finalists and made public in a report by the campus newspaper, The State News. Aimi, spelled E-I-G-H-M-Y, reacted by dropping out, and Guskowitz soon faced questions, including from his own trustees, over his pursuing jobs elsewhere without their knowledge. The trustee told Newsline this week, "These processes are supposed to be confidential. When you have a board that can't keep things confidential, and would say some that don't even want to keep them confidential, it really hobbles your ability to have a good candidate pool, to feel like you are getting the very best candidate." If the board ultimately offers Guskowitz the presidency, said this trustee, there will always be those members who feel he was the final candidate, not on his merits, but because someone had leaked confidential information, tainted the search, and prompted another candidate to drop out. He said, "That's not fair to Guskowitz to make him begin that way, and it's again something for our board to fight about and for people to hold a grudge over if he's hired the entire time he's here." If Guskowitz is looking for an exit from a politically tense environment that features tension with governing boards, the trustee said, Michigan State may be more of a change of venue than an actual change of circumstance. Saying, "I think we have a really trying environment here right now, just going from crisis to crisis. I know from reading up on his situation at Carolina that he's used to that, but I'm not sure he's used to this." Finally, if Guskowitz doesn't make the move to Michigan State, things may become even more difficult for him at Carolina. While he's had a rocky tenure, often butting heads with political appointees on both the Board of Governors and trustees, he would now be leading the campus with his governing board knowing he's been looking for a position elsewhere. Kotis, Boliak, and other trustees told Newsline this week that their board hadn't known Guskowitz was looking. Finding out through the media creates an issue of trust between the chancellor and trustees. He said, "You know, if he's looking somewhere else, it's really hard for that job search not to cloud his actions here, because you'd then be looking at all your actions through the lens of, well, how's this going to affect my next job?" Trustees would have to wonder, Kotis said, whether actions Guskowitz takes now are in the best interest of the university or are part of his auditioning for a position he's pursuing elsewhere. "I really think that's a bit of a challenge," he says. "I think if we're asking him, is he looking, and he's saying no, but yet he really is, there's the trust issue then that can come up. There's also the question of whether time and energy Guskowitz should be spending on UNC Chapel Hill business is instead going into searching for his next position," said Kotis. "Guskowitz can take a one-year paid sabbatical, during which an interim chancellor could be appointed. That could be a potential solution," Kotis finally said. "If he's looking, then he could spend all his time focused on that, instead of trying to balance both." This article is about radio station WUNC, which originates, as we know, at Chapel Hill, but it actually is one of the largest stations in the entire South. In the month since Due South debuted on WUNC, episodes of this new radio program have included an interview with North Carolina Senate Leader Phil Berger, a segment on Halloween confections at area bakeries, and a discussion about a local effort to center indigenous stories in college courses. This should tell you something about the capaciousness of the show and the breadth of experience of the people behind it. Co-hosted by veteran WUNC reporter Jeff Tiberi and Leonita Inge, Due South provides the sort of regional radio coverage that has been absent from this station since 2020, when The State of Things, a daily program that covered North Carolina topics for more than a decade, was discontinued. But Due South isn't a duplicate of its predecessor. For one thing, the show, which airs daily at 10 a.m., is not live. Segments are recorded days or sometimes even months in advance, making for more deep dives and less spur-of-the-moment coverage. And as the name suggests, Due South is not confined to the state of North Carolina, and it offers expansive coverage from across the American South and affords as much attention to culture as it does to politics. As co-host, Inge, who has reported on race and Southern culture at UNC since 2002, and Tiberi, who spent 8 years as Capitol Bureau Chief for North Carolina Public Radio, play to their strengths. The end result is a broadcast that's both curated and colloquial, niche and contextualized. It has that great NPR quality where you can tune in at any point and almost immediately catch on to what's being discussed. During Due South's third week on the air, the Indy sat down with Tiberi and Inge to discuss the show's inception and trajectory. So this is like a Q&A format. How did Due South come to be? Jeff, after the state of things was gone, I said to the bosses, what's the plan? We've got to have a daily show at a station this size, in an area of this caliber, with so many universities, so much growth, being the political state that it is, the culturally rich place that it is, we have to have a daily show. I think both Leonita and I would agree that we work for our listeners. That's the guiding star for us, and our listeners haven't had a show for years. So I'm very excited that it's finally here. There are lots of stories and segments and conversations that we want to get to. Both of you have been WUNC reporters for a long time. How does your past experience inform Due South? I'm curious whether this show feels like a culmination of your previous work, an entirely new venture, or a little of both. Jeff, it's a little bit of both. There's nothing new about sitting down across from someone important or someone who has a level of familiarity with our audience and chatting with them. But it's a new endeavor in that a lot more people are listening to it now. Also, my reflexive nature is to go to elected officials to get answer to questions. But with Leonita, there's a difference. Leonita holds court. Wherever she goes, it just happens organically. Leonita knows everyone. Leonita. Some radio hosts are just talking head hosts. People prepare everything for them, and they present it. As reporters, we never had that luxury. We've had to meet as many people as possible. So we have a repertoire of people in every corner. My experience, says the Indy Week, working for a local publication as being that even though our focus is the Triangle, there are sometimes really glaring national or international news items that it feels like we need to cover in some way. Where does Due South fall on that? Do you have any interest or a feeling of obligation to cover broader news topics through a Southern lens? Jeff answers, I would say yes. We're trying to zag a little bit, and we want people to zig. For one thing, we know that if there's something playing out in the national or international ecosystem, like the president is impeached, it's going to be on UNC's airwaves throughout the day. We know that our listeners are going to be covered. So then becomes this question of, do we address certain topics? And if we do, how do we go about it in a way that isn't repetitive? How do we address them with a local tilt, a local slant? Obviously, the biggest one right now is this awful calamity in the Middle East, which we have not spent a whole lot of time on yet. I think it's something that we'll touch on in the Friday news roundups. The roundups are by no means a catch-all, but they are a place where we can drop things in, be it the latest war or something environmental, something economic, in a 2 or 3 minute window. Whereas other days of the week, our segment lengths are 20 minutes, 12 minutes, 20, 17 minutes. Sometimes the time windows are limiting in the sense of, oh, like this is a big thing going on. How are we going to talk about that for 12 minutes without it feeling out of place? Leonidas says, we've heard that people welcome a different take on content at the time of day that Due South airs. At that point in the morning, listeners have been getting it hard from the BBC. They've been hearing them talk about war for an hour. Our goal is to discuss things you didn't even know you wanted to hear. Even something like a simple interview about having the fall leaves turned. Have they turned in your area yet, or is it too late? People plan their weddings around these leaves. Those leaves can be a big economic boost for communities. Stories like that you don't usually hear. The first Due South episode I heard, says Indy, was what's at stake in the municipal elections, one which, topic-wise, was sort of what I expected to hear when I turned on NPR in the morning. Then 2 days later, I turned the radio on again and heard y'all doing a wide-ranging interview with Paula Poundstone. I'm not used to hearing a daily radio show that has so much variety. The show reminds me of the Indy in some ways in that you give equal weight to politics and culture. Jeff goes, one of the ways I've thought about the show is reliable, not predictable. News fatigue is real. We want people to learn. We want people to laugh. When I listen to the show, there's moments when I will smile, and that's okay. You're not breaking the rules by smiling if you're listening to the radio or if you're listening to news. News is by no means myopic. We're trying to cover a large range of topics, and the through line is the South. The through line is interesting people and things you might not know about or might not know enough about. Leonida, I'm a real stickler about that. I don't want a topic to have been heard too many times on other programs at all. There's no way to run out of stories. There's no way to run out of people to talk to. I want to even be more of a stickler. Jeff says, she's a stickler, if you can't tell. Leonida, no, I mean, I'm just saying I want it to be so clear and passionate that people in New York are jealous. I bought up the model of Garden and Gun magazine. When Garden and Gun first started, they were trying to be a Southern literary magazine to challenge the New Yorker, but then it just built into its own big phenom. They cover the South hard. The New Yorker's probably now sometimes scared to do some stories or interview some people because Garden and Gun has so clearly owned the Southern region. So that's kind of how I see our show. We are one of the biggest stations in the whole South, period. So we should just hold that and own it. Own where you are. Moving over to Raleigh and statewide issues, first, Governor Cooper has appointed former Wake County Commissioner Jessica Holmes as the new state auditor to complete the remainder of Beth Wood's term as state auditor. Cooper selected attorney Jessica Holmes. Jessica understands how government can be a force for good, but that the details matter and it's important that we do things the right way, he said at a press conference. Holmes acknowledged that Wood was the first woman ever elected to serve as state auditor and that she herself would be the first African-American woman to serve on the North Carolina Council of State. Holmes told reporters, that said, I'm here today not because I'm black, not because I'm a woman, because I'm the person to do the job and my credentials back that up. She's not a certified public accountant like Wood, but she oversaw a $1.5 billion budget while serving as a Wake County Commissioner. She will take over the role starting December 15th, when current Auditor Wood leaves that post. Wood had hoped to serve out the remainder of her term, telling members of the House Oversight and Reform Committee, we've got 14 months to kick some butt. A week later, she was indicted on a misdemeanor charge of misusing a state vehicle. That indictment followed an accident involving a state-issued vehicle last December, to which she pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor hit-and-run charge involving a parked car and paid the damage. For her part, Holmes said she will not be accepting or receiving a state vehicle. With 30 years of public service, Wood retained the respect of Republicans and Democrats alike in state government. There was praise for Wood's service and thanks for it. Next, a Wake County man accused of committing a series of non-fatal air gun shootings was released on bond last night after spending nearly 3 years in jail. Henderson Atwater's release came in the wake of a Monday hearing that saw his bond reduced from $1.5 million to $100,000. It's a significant development in a court case marked by police incompetence and a stunning lack of evidence. Atwater was tried on 17 charges in August this year, and the jury was hung, leading the presiding judge Paul Ridgway to declare a mistrial. Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman intends to retry Atwater on the same charges at a future proceeding. At the bond reduction hearing Monday, Atwater's defense attorneys presented Ridgway with a slideshow of evidence that had not been exhibited at the August trial, including a case report revealing that Holly Springs police had at one point cleared Atwater as a suspect, based on the same surveillance footage that at trial they said showed Atwater. The defense attorneys did not present this evidence in August because they forfeited their right to make a case, a decision made in part because the lead defense attorney, William Pruden, told Indy the state withheld a large amount of discovery until several weeks before the trial, thwarting the defense's ability to prepare. The slideshow Pruden and defense attorney Chad Axford presented on Monday emphasized how key pieces of discovery had been sent to them at the last minute, with dates of receipt labeled in a bright red font. Atwater cried tears of joy when the judge agreed to reduce his bond and tightly embraced family members upon his release. A vocational rehab consultant will help Atwater find employment, Pruden says, and the family is currently raising money to cover legal fees and costs associated with his electronic monitoring device. And speaking of statewide articles and stories, this knife death slaying at Southeast Raleigh High School with a young teen accused of murder of another teen there. There have been many, 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 many stories about this. And so there are two stories, both by Greg Childress, one in November and one just a couple days ago, gathering to discuss the situation among pastors, business leaders, educators, and other folks. And I will leave those and not read them, remembering that you can read and see those stories at indieweek.com. Even far into the future, because they're all kept in on file there at that website, indieweek.com. And instead, I'll move on to some in my 10 minutes left remaining to something else. Instead, I'll read an article by Sarah Edwards about a writer, Rebecca Bengal. This was written in September 25th. The writer, Rebecca Bengal, has been one of the coolest beats around, though I couldn't precisely define what it is. She writes fiction and nonfiction, with reporting on everything from Standing Rock protests and Tove Jansson to Rihanna and Graceland. More than once, though, I've clicked on a headline about poetry or photography or some forgotten country music singer, and I intuited her byline before I spotted it. More so than a single genre, her writing feels distinctive for its continued considerations of time and the way it shapes and reshapes our relationship to art. In Strange Hours, Bengal's capacious new essay collection out last month from Aperture, time acts as a framing device for 17 pieces, mostly essays, although it also includes an interview and short story about the lives of some of the past century's most iconic photographers. Bengal writes, "A photograph lives in multiple eras at once," as she interviews Nan Golden, travels to Minneapolis with Alex Soth to find and photograph the past homes of Prince and invokes title cards, past tense, time out of time, in an essay about documentary photographer and the slipperiness of the pandemic clock. The result in this slim purple volume, a fitting Prince haunted color, is a new classic that can help us better engage with both visual culture and the world around us. And that is an article by Sarah Edwards about Rebecca Bengel, which is titled, I Don't Like to Know the End. And I'll put that aside, just calling it to those attentions, who people's attention, who would like to read more about this woman and her work. Let's dig into, at least at the surface, of a couple of music-related articles, a few of them. One about a group, Maple Stave, which has released on August 1st, Arguments. Jordan Lawrence writes, among the more satisfying aspects of writing about music on the local level is being around for the scrappy bands that keep coming back and getting a little better every time. Maple Stave is one such band. The Durham Oddity emerged as a mathy instro-punk trio in the mid-aughts, powered by clobbering drummer Evan Rao, with Christopher Williams and Andy Hull adding hefty intricacy by opting for the lower sound of baritone guitars. They've patiently refined and enhanced their sound over the years, adding lyrics and singing, and in 2019, the steadying bass of Chris Rasmussen. Since 2010, they've released a new album every 6 or 7 years, reaffirming and extending their powers with each release. And so it is again on Arguments, the first album to feature Rasmussen. Released in August, the album finds Maple Stave reestablishing itself as one of the Triangle's most distinct and compelling hard rock acts. The album alternates instrumentals and songs with singing until the closing trio of lyric-forward tracks, and serves as both a more taut and succinct answer to instro-rock titans like Pelican and Russian Circles, and a more cerebral variant of the fussed-over but feral punk offered by the likes of Birds in a Row. The instrumentals, welcome palate cleansers between Williams' intense existential outburst, showcase Maple Stave's adept touch for ratcheting tension with propulsive rhythm and textural contrast as Williams and Hull confront wiry and higher-end playing with lower-end tumult that rumbles confidently. The other songs key on the band's ability to continuously escalate momentum to transform Williams' melancholic ruminations into cathartic expulsions of exasperation and dejection. The returns are somewhat repetitive, but aren't terribly diminished. And that is enough of that article by Jordan Lawrence, who gives Arguments by Maple Stave 3.5 stars. And on October 3rd, a group called, the Raleigh band called Truth Club, released Running from the Chase on Double Double Whammy Records. In early October, that ominous Bible verse first began appearing around Trinity Park on flyers that also pleaded for Durham neighbors to stop smoking cigarettes and blasting sacrilegious Truth Club music. That ominous Bible verse, it's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. The posters received attention on Twitter and Reddit, though the blasphemous local band in question wasn't behind the gimmick originally. While selling merchandise at the band's October set at the Bowery Ballroom, Truth Club drummer Elise Jaff explained that a friend came up with the idea and sent them videos. The group was quickly on board, and a street team shtick about devil's music does seem to capture the band's current moment. Truth Club may have a fresh new album, Running from the Chase, released in October, raking in praise and recognition, but they still have the feel of a college band with a grounded sense of humor. Pitchfork's Stuart Berman wrote in a recent glowing review of this album, if Wednesday are like the super chunk-esque rallying point of the current North Carolina scene, then Truth Club are like the more enigmatic and forbidding Polvo, deploying more oblique strategies to similarly addressing arresting ends. It's a comparison that someone was bound to make for a scrappy band born of the triangle, but one that limits Truth Club to the world of its local predecessors. In turn, in truth, though, the sound the band is etching out feels like less like a replica of the grunge era and more like a revitalization of the best parts of the old scene and a continuation of its story. Truth Club began their 2023 tour with Chicago indie act Squirrel Flower in Asheville, staying with the same friends they did in 2019 when they first began playing as a quartet. At that time, the club was composed of childhood friends, lead singer and guitarist Travis Harrington, Jaffe and bassist Cameron Vaughn, and had already begun receiving attention from national music outlets. Their first album, 2019's Not an Exit, earned them a spot on Stereo Gum's Best New Bands of 2019 list, alongside Black Midi and Faye Webster. At the time the list dropped, though, the band had been on a hiatus for about a month and canceled their set at Hopscotch Music Festival that year. Despite the hiatus and soon after the pandemic, with its unforgiving effects on local music scenes nationwide, the group began working on what would become Running from the Chase, piecing riffs and lyrics together over time to create an album that gracefully succeeded the first. Continuing, the band is older, no longer college students performing as friends, but musicians trying to carve out their own space in the local scene. The album oscillates between upbeat, guitar-heavy tracks and slow, sadder jams. Blue Eternal, a 2-minute track that opens with amp feedback and the exclamation, "Found You Again," feeds into 77X with a heavy bass line and Harrington's croon matching the tempo. Finally, back in 2019, the group had also brought on bassist and keyboard Ivan Chazal, whom Jaffe knew through work with Girls Rock NC. And there, despite running my mouth as fast as I can, I cannot complete that article either. And again, Indie Week will find you as much and more information about local music scene, statewide music scene, and others. Meanwhile, this particular broadcast is drawing to a close, and it will be available as a podcast after our Friday release, Friday evening. And so for Indie Week, John Federson will bid you a fond farewell, and I'm going off to get a throat lozenge. So long, everybody.